This evening we are going to be talking about the end of verse 16 where Paul says that when God saw fit to call him through his grace to reveal the Son in Paul so that he could preach him among the Gentiles, he says, I did not immediately, or in the literal, immediately, I did not consult with flesh and blood. Nor did I go up to Jerusalem to those who were apostles before me, but I went away to Arabia and returned once more to Damascus. So in this statement, he is actually saying that when God unveiled this reality of the Son in a human being as the basis for the activity that would follow, the preaching or whatever the individual's gift was, that he didn't take the time or engage in discussion of all of this doctrinal stuff with anybody that's known as flesh and blood. And that's where we're going to be going this evening in our understanding. Words are words, but they have meaning. And there are a ton of things that make it difficult to believe anything God says. There are so many competing concepts that have been injected into the thoughts of humanity over the last 6,000 years, with entire cultures built around lies. In fact, all cultures are built around lies, so that the people are subject to the cultures, grow up in this atmosphere of deception and delusion. And as a consequence, when God says something, it just does not ring as true to the vast majority of human beings, and it makes it a very difficult thing to believe God. But the problem with that is there are extraordinary consequences associated with denying truth and believing lies. Because on the one hand, the failure to believe, the Bible says, leads automatically to the greatest unmitigated disaster that human mind can even conceive. In fact, can't conceive of, because it's an eternal destruction away from the presence of the Lord, and the implications of that are just off the chart. But on the other hand, faith in the things that God says, Paul says, will lead to a kind of glory that can't even be discussed now in this present time, because there's nothing comparable to it. And so to even try to present it in some ways is an impossibility, because it's so far beyond anything that we could ask or think or even anticipate, so that it hasn't even entered into the heart of man what God has prepared for those who love him. That's Paul's foundation. And so on the one hand, unbelief leads to enormous disaster, and faith leads to an indescribable glory. And that's the essence of the impact of faith. When you believe something that's true, or when you reject something that's true. So when you talk about getting people to believe things, it's very difficult. And it's even complicated further by the fact that when we talk about the consequences, you know, eternal destruction away from the presence of the Lord, or indescribable glory that hasn't even entered into the mind of man, when we talk about those, we're talking about future developments that most people just blow off immediately. Because in terms of faith, people are way more interested in the immediate present than they are in the future possibilities. I mean, you go into any given church building on any given summer morning, and you're not in there 10 minutes, and you're certainly not into the sermon more than 5 or 10 minutes before the people that are uncomfortably warm are so caught up in the fact that they're starting to sweat that they can't even listen. And the ones here sitting under the air conditioner thing is blowing right on. They're so cold they can't pay attention either, because this is the immediate present. I'm freezing, or I'm burning up. And whatever's going on around them is whoo. And that's just the nature of the beast. We're that way. We're interested in how we're being affected right now in this immediate present, and the possibilities of the future are pfft. And that's not even the worst part. The worst part is all of us living in the immediate present often are far more hung up on the past than we are on the promises of the future. We often are so caught up on something that happened to us, it might have been 30 years ago or 50 years ago, But it still dominates us in such a way that we can't even get past it long enough to anticipate what glory there might be associated with just turning it loose. But the fact is, we're talking here about trying to get people to believe something God has said, and it's a very difficult process. And yet, that's Paul's job in Galatians. The book of Galatians is written to get a group of people that had the gospel preached to them and they had believed it. And yet, as soon as Paul and his group had left, in came some infiltrators and they began to contradict and they began to make accusations against Paul's character and status. And they said, he's not really an apostle. You know, he never even saw Jesus when he was on the planet. Or if he did, he was an enemy. And yada, 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 yada. And so they undercut everything that Paul had preached. No, well, not everything. But the core of what Paul had preached. Salvation by grace through faith. And the Galatians were listening to that. And they were beginning to drift. And Paul's job was to summon them back to this immutable truth. So that they could lock in on it by faith and say, no, this is true. Not that. No, this is true and not that. No, this is true and not that. In every situation where God has uttered a statement of truth, people are summoned to say, okay, that's true, and its alternatives are not. Or its contrary alternatives are not. So this evening, what Paul is doing in verse 16 is actually getting into what he had said back there in verses 11 and 12. In verses 11 and 12, we said when we were studying those that that's the thesis statement for the entire rest of chapter 1. And the thesis is, I would have you know, brethren, that the gospel which is preached by me is not according to man. I didn't receive it from a man. I wasn't taught it by a man. I received it through a revelation of Jesus Christ. That's the thesis statement for the paragraph. And it is in verse 16 where he actually starts saying, I didn't get this from a man because, he says, as soon as God saw fit to reveal His Son in me, I didn't talk to any human beings, any flesh and blood people. I went off into Arabia and then I came back to Damascus. And when I came back to Damascus, he doesn't say that here, but when Paul came back to Damascus, he was preaching Christ. The first time that Paul got in trouble for preaching the gospel was in Damascus. And they had to let him down over this wall of the city in a basket to get him out of town before somebody killed him. I mean, that's how bad it was. But that meant that when he came back out of Arabia, he knew what he was preaching. He knew the gospel. But he had never talked to flesh and blood. So really, verse 16 is the beginning of a declaration of what the thesis statement was in verses 11 and 12. From verse 13 through 15, or at least up to 15, the argument isn't, I didn't get this from a man. The argument was, you really ought to pay attention to what I'm saying because this message altered my fundamental attitude about life altogether. Formerly I was this way, now I'm exactly the opposite. And when a message has that capacity, then you need to give it some thought. And especially, let me be real clear here, any message is going to have an impact. Anything that anybody believes is going to alter the way they behave if what they believe means that they've stopped believing something that they had formerly believed. So obviously people's lives are going to be changed. I've heard all kinds of people say, well, you know, when I became a, and then they'll name whatever kind of quasi-Christian organization they might have joined, life just completely changed for me. Well, sure, you started believing things you hadn't believed before. That's automatic. But that doesn't make them true. It just means they're life-changing. Because faith does that. When you believe something, it changes the way you act. And when you don't believe something, that is revealed in the actions you take. Because they're guided by the beliefs you hold. So, the argument that it changed my life isn't, of itself, a very strong argument. Except for the fact that the change in Paul was a change from an aggressive self-promoter who was stepping on heads and scratching and clawing to get to the top in his generation to a man who would sacrifice himself even to the maximum for even people who opposed him, his own enemies. That's the nature of radical change, because it took him from being a hateful man and turned him into a loving man. And any message that can make a person genuinely loving needs to be given some serious thought. Because being genuinely loving is not human at all. I mean, that's clear out of here. That's why Paul in Romans 9, when he said, I could wish myself to be accursed from Christ for the sake of my kinsmen according to the flesh. That's why I preceded it with three statements in verse 1. I'm telling the truth, I'm telling the truth, I'm telling the truth. He said it three different ways, but he said, I'm not lying. My conscience is bearing witness in the Holy Spirit. And he wanted to make sure they believed him, but what he said was unbelievable. Because what he said was, I actually love people who don't even like me so much that I would be willing to be accursed from Christ for eternity for their sake if it would bring them into life. And because the idea of going to hell forever for somebody else's sake is so, I mean, just don't easily make that kind of a commitment of love. That's just over the top. So when I say if a message actually makes you loving, I'm not talking about the squishy stuff that we'd call love. I'm talking about the real willingness to suffer personal loss, significant personal loss, even up to eternal loss, just because somebody else needs that sacrifice to be made on their behalf. That's just over the top. So any message that can make you that way, obviously, has to be coming from a God whose love is that way. So that's his argument. It's not just that it changes life, but it changes in such a radical way. So in the first three verses of the paragraph, for which the thesis statement is, I make known to you that this gospel is not human, he doesn't talk about it not being human until he gets to verse 16. I don't like the New American Standard here. It's true. But the word immediately is at the first of the phrase. And I like it there better because it says, when God saw fit to reveal his son to me that I might preach among the Gentiles, immediately I did not consult with flesh and blood, nor did I go up to Jerusalem. I went away to Arabia immediately. And his whole point is something. We want to examine what does this mean that he did not consult with flesh and blood, and what is the significance of that meaning. We know that he's saying that he didn't talk to anybody. But why did he say it that way? What does it mean to consult, and why does he use flesh and blood? Those are the issues of our study this evening. And on the face of it, it has something to do with Paul saying, I didn't talk this out with anybody. You remember when he went into Damascus blind? What did he do? Do you remember?
He went to his house and was praying. He couldn't see.
Right.
He was
fasting and praying. He wasn't eating, and he was praying because he didn't know what had happened. He knew that he'd been confronted by Jesus of Nazareth in the Shekinah glory of God on the road to Damascus and blinded his eyes, and he was now blind, and he had heard this voice in the Shekinah say that it was Jesus of Nazareth whom Saul was persecuting, and that just rocked his whole world. Absolutely down to the bottom foundations, because he was so sure this was a heresy. So in his anguish of confusion, he's refused to eat and he's praying. And God sent Ananias to him over Ananias' objections. And do you remember what Ananias told him? Anything about what he said? Or what God said to Ananias about Saul? Yeah. And God told Ananias when he was objecting, he said, go. He is a chosen vessel of mine to carry this message to the nation. And Ananias went to Saul and he told him, you know, you need to arise and be baptized, washing away this blindness and embracing this thing that you just had proved to you is true, that Jesus of Nazareth is the Christ, the redemptive sacrifice for all the sins of humanity. Well, that means that out of Ananias' mouth came the core issues of the gospel right there. So when Paul said, I didn't consult with flesh and blood, it doesn't mean that he didn't have any indication of the gospel, because he did, a little, at least there. But he says his reaction was to not go into any detail with anybody on this. That consult, that word means to enter into a detailed discussion, interaction, back and forth on what the significance of this is in a lot of different areas. He went off into Arabia instead. Well, I want us to think about that in light of his thesis that he didn't get his message from men. This gospel, he says, is not human. It is divine revelation. It's truth straight from God. And his first proof is the change of his character from hateful to loving. And the next one is he didn't talk to anybody in depth. But in light of that claim and what the book of Acts tells us about Saul of Tarsus, we need to understand a little bit. So I want to clarify. There is no way that Paul, as Saul, could have been unaware of the broad outlines of the content of the gospel. There's no way. Chapter 9 of Acts, verse 1, says that Saul was the ringleader of the opposition, and he was breathing out threatenings and slaughter. In Acts chapter 7, Saul of Tarsus was standing and holding the garments of those who stoned Stephen to death. And Acts 7 is a long record of the sermon that Stephen preached, and Saul of Tarsus heard it. Okay? So, number one, he's heard the preaching from Stephen. He is the ringleader of the opposition, which means he can't be totally ignorant of what's going on. And then you add to that his own personal testimony in Acts 22:3, where he says that he is a man from Tarsus, but he says, I was brought up in Jerusalem at the feet of Gamaliel. Now, who was Gamaliel? What do you know about him?
He was the principal theologian of
today. Yeah, he was the highest, most respected disciple maker in Pharisaism in Paul's day. It was Gamaliel in Acts chapter 5 who, when the disciples were brought before the Sanhedrin, stood up and said, put those guys in another room. I have something I need to talk with you guys outside of their presence. So they dismissed the apostles, and then he told them, he said, listen, there have been a lot of guys over the last few decades who have risen in Israel claiming to be something. And all we had to do was wait a little while, and it proved they weren't who they were, because it all fell apart on them. He said, these guys are a little different from that, and we haven't given it time to find out whether their stuff's true or not. So my advice to you is don't mess with these guys. You might be fighting against God. If you're not, then it'll fall apart on its own. But if you are, you're not going to win. If you're fighting God, you're not going to win. And it says they gave heed to his words. So this is the guy who taught Paul, or Saul of Tarsus. So my point in saying all of these things is, when Paul says, I didn't get my message from men, it's not a human thing, he is not discounting the exposure that he had to the message in his personal history. I mean, he's not saying that Luke lied about all the stuff in Acts. But there is another reference in Acts, chapter 5, verse 28, that I think gives a cast to all this reality in such a way that it makes it possible for people to hear sermons like Stephen and just miss the point altogether. In Acts 5:28, when the religious leaders were having this heavy conflict with the apostles, they said in Acts 5, you're intending to bring this man's blood upon us. That's a joke. Why? Yeah. When Pilate said, he hadn't done anything wrong. I'm washing my hands. His blood be on us and on our children. We want him dead. And now they don't like the idea that his blood is being laid to their account. So they're really angry that they're being accused of something that they earlier said they'd be willing to accept without any problem. They wanted him dead, and it didn't matter to them if his blood was on their hands or whatever. So when you are feeling like somebody's accusing you of something that's really, really, really bad, and by Acts 5, it's really, really, really bad. Because by Acts 5, the day of Pentecost is over. The 3,000 people have been converted to Christianity in one sermon. Jesus has been rumored to have been raised from the dead and seen by over 500 people. To have his blood laid at your doorstep by this time in the game is something that you really don't want to accept. So when you're being accused at that level, it just blinds you to everything. So you can sit and listen to Stephen and Peter and all these preachers, but all the while their words are coming out of their mouth, you're thinking, they're trying to blame me for this. So there's a tremendous blindness that is over the heart and mind of the individual simply because of the accusation and of the guilt that's coming in here. So I really believe that Saul and those of his kind were so hung up on this guilt thing that they really didn't understand the details. If you'd have asked them to explain the details of the gospel, they probably couldn't have done it. You remember the time when Jesus asked his disciples, "Who do men say that I am?" Well, this was after he'd cleansed lepers, raised people from the dead, healed every kind of imaginable disease, cast out demons, even cast out a legion of demons on one occasion, just under 6,000. After all that, he says, now, what's the impact of all this behavior of mine had on the people? Who do they say that I am? And you remember the answers?
Elijah, John the Baptist.
You bet. All off the wall. Everything except the Christ. Now, the question is, okay, how can you be confronted with that level of argument in terms of evidence and still just miss it? Well, there's got to be a blindness. So when Paul was saying in chapter 1, my message didn't come from human being, and he then begins to argue that part of my argument is I never had these details worked out in a consultation with the people that had the information. He's not denying that he'd been exposed to all this stuff. He's not denying that he opposed it enormously. He's simply saying, I never got the details from a human being. And also keep this in mind. What brand of religious leader was Saul? What party did he belong to? Yeah, he's a Pharisee of the Pharisees, he said. What was that theologically, a Pharisee? What kind of a, what was his basic conviction? Yeah, and the Bible's the Word of God, and the Bible's important, and we need to know. And so as a Pharisee, he was thoroughly conversant with conservative, scriptural, biblical Judaism, as far as they understood. Now, those scriptures that Saul was thoroughly conversant with included Isaiah 53. And Isaiah 53 is the clearest Old Testament presentation of the gospel that you'll find anywhere in the Old Testament. Because it's in Isaiah 53 that the servant is put to death on behalf of the sheep who've gone astray, and the Lord has laid on him the iniquity of us all, and all of that terminology. I mean, we love Isaiah 53 because it justifies our gospel, but it was there first. And Saul knew that. Saul of Tarsus knew that text. He knew those passages. So when he says, I didn't consult, he's saying there were a whole lot of the underlying details that never had surfaced in all of my exposure to everything that I had been exposed to. The details had never surfaced, and I didn't talk them over with anybody. So what Paul is actually doing in his claim is saying the revelation of the gospel to himself had two parts to it. One of them was a general exposure from multiple sources. He didn't deny that he'd heard Stephen's sermon and all that. There was a general exposure from a whole lot of sources that he was subject to as a first century Pharisee within the boundaries and foundations of Jerusalem, because he said, I was raised in Jerusalem under Gamaliel. But there is another thing, and that is, beyond the general exposure, there is a necessity for specific comprehensive exposure from Jesus Christ himself. You remember when, as we said earlier, he said, who do the people say I am? And they gave all these answers. And then he said, well, who do you say that I am? And Peter said, you're the Christ. And what did Jesus say to him? What? Yeah, only his terminology was this. Flesh and blood has not revealed that to you, but my Father who's in heaven. He used the very term, flesh and blood, that is used here. Now that's going to be important in a few minutes, but the thing that I'm trying to say is, it is a part of Paul's personal and biblical theology that general information, valid, even potent demonstration of information is not sufficient to give a person an understanding of the gospel. You can be subject to miracles and sermons and you name it. And that doesn't mean that you're going to understand that Jesus is the Christ. Apart from special, divine, we would call it illumination probably, as opposed to, you know, content revelation. We would say the content was this, and the illumination enabled Peter to say, okay, he is the Christ. So we would make some distinction between revelation and illumination. But the scriptures don't make that distinction. They call it revelation. That was revealed to you by my Father. Now, that's important in his argument here, because even in Paul's argument, if you study Galatians chapters 1 and 2 in detail, apart from any work by the Spirit in your heart and mind, you will go away from those two chapters still in a fog about whether this is a trustworthy word from God or not. I mean, you'll read it, you'll understand what it says, but when it comes to making decisions, you won't make them on the basis of what this book says, because it's still not a matter of your faith. Faith, it comes out of revelation, specific, personal, from God to you, your mind and heart. So I really believe that that's what Paul's claim is being brought down to, that there's a general exposure from a lot of sources, and then there's a specific comprehensive exposure from God himself. And that's the way it was with me. I don't know about your personal testimony, but I'd been lots of Baptist revivals. I'd heard the gospel preached from all kinds of evangelistic efforts. But the day I heard the gospel with the result that I believed it was like I'd never heard this before. And I know good and well I had. But there just wasn't, you know, there wasn't that, oh, the light didn't come on until then. Well, that light coming on with illuminating understanding is what the scriptures would say. My Father has just revealed this to you. So when Paul said he didn't confer with flesh and blood, that just means that he didn't enter into a drawn-out process of hammering out the details of the message behind the wide and potent exposure to which he'd been subjected. I mean, he'd heard about the miracles and he'd heard the sermon and But the word consulting is used in the scriptures only twice, and both of them are in this book. And in this book, where it's used both times, the context is the nuts and bolts of the gospel under some kind of in-depth, give-and-take discussion of those particulars, so that there comes out a comprehensive, true message that is supported in all of these details. And the person who has consulted has worked his way through all of that. And Paul says, that never happened with me at the human level, that is with flesh and blood. Now that raises this question. Why does he call us flesh and blood? I mean, what's the point? There are lots of ways you can say, I didn't talk to anybody. You can say, I didn't talk to anybody. Or, I didn't talk to any man. Or, however you want to say it. But he said, I didn't consult with flesh and blood. Well, what's the issue of the flesh and blood thing? Why does he call human beings flesh and blood in this context? And I believe the answer is because Paul is falling back on a general biblical teaching that flesh and blood has a particular significance. When you look up the references to flesh and blood, invariably the flesh and blood concept comes out as a human being who is incompetent in light of some required issue. He can't do it. Is he incompetent? That's where you first ran into it in Matthew 16. Who do you say that I am? Well, you're the Christ. Comes across like, whoa, I got this figured out. And so Jesus says, now Peter, you did not figure that out. Flesh and blood did not reveal that to you. It's not something you can take credit for. You're not smarter than all these other people who are so dumb they think I'm John the Baptizer. It's not that. Flesh and blood didn't do this for you. The only reason you see it differently than they do is because my Father revealed it to you. So that the flesh and blood concept in that text is, flesh and blood is incompetent when it comes to drawing legitimate conclusions from factual data. If you want to know the truth about God, the factual data can be there, but flesh and blood won't get you to the understanding. That's the initial indication of the concept of flesh and blood. It's man as an incompetent person in the light of the issue of real understanding. And then in 1 Corinthians 15:50, Paul just point blankly says, flesh and blood can't inherit the kingdom of God. Why not? Didn't Jesus go into the kingdom in his resurrected flesh and blood? No. When he stood in the midst of the disciples in the upper room, what did he say? Flesh and bones. He didn't say flesh and blood. Because the flesh and bones thing is a whole different ballgame. Flesh and blood means there's something broken here. And because there's something broken about flesh and blood, it can't enter the kingdom. Flesh and blood's got to be put to death in order for you to get into the kingdom. That's why your body's not going to heaven in its present flesh and blood condition. It's going to either have to be instantaneously transformed at the rapture, or you're going to have to die, and that flesh and blood body is going to have to deteriorate into dust, so that when you're raised from the dead, you will be raised incorruptible, not subject to the weakness anymore. So the flesh and blood thing is a deliberate biblical concept of man and his weakness and incapacity. And those issues may be something as simple as benign incompetency. I mean, you know, like for example, the lawnmower is broken and won't start. But you need to mow the grass, so you send your 4-year-old son out there to fix the lawnmower. And he comes in a little while and says, I can't, Daddy. You say, well, why can't you? Well, I'm just 4 years old. Well, that's a benign incompetency. There's anything wrong with that. It's not his fault that he can't fix the lawnmower. Now, Riggs might be able to when he's four, but the rest of us are just going to have to say, I can't, Daddy. But the point that I'm making here is the flesh and blood concept could be a benign incompetency, but it may be far more weighted in the direction of antagonism toward God. Because it is the flesh and blood that says to the disciples, you're trying to lay his blood at our feet. And that means we're already resisting. We're already fighting. We don't want this assignment of guilt assigned to us, even though earlier we said we'd accept it. See the hypocrisy, the evil, the antagonism? So flesh and blood is not just a minor issue, it's you can't get there from here in terms of flesh and blood. The claim that Paul made that he didn't immediately consult with flesh and blood is a claim that accepts and depends on the fact that messages are easily misconstrued and misunderstood at the popular level, and they possess a myriad of interrelated details that make a consistent presentation of them impossible until and unless the preacher gets a legitimate exposure to those core details and the radiating truths that flare out from the core by some method that gives him true understanding of them. And in the Bible, that only comes from God. When Solomon was faced with the responsibility of being a king over Israel, he turned to God and he asked him for what? Wisdom. Could ask him for gold or popularity or whatever. But he knew there was only one thing that would enable him to be a legitimate king, and that is the wisdom of God. And because he asked for wisdom, God also gave him what he didn't ask for. Became the wealthiest king in all of Israel's history. The point that I'm trying to make here is that when Paul said, I didn't consult with flesh and blood, he's saying that would have been a hopeless consulting anyway. My gospel did not come through this human agency thing. Now, what's the significance of all that? What difference does it make? Well, I think the fact that Paul is attempting to distance the gospel from human ingenuity is a given. I think that's the bottom line. It's a given. If you can say that the message of this book, I mean, if you can do like so many people in our generation do and say, well, the Bible was written by men. It's just another human book. It's just the best thoughts of whatever. If you can say that, you can easily dismiss anything in it that you don't want to hear. Well, that's just your opinion. Or however you want to dismiss it. Because it's human. It doesn't matter. They could be wrong. And since they could be wrong, I'm just going to assume that if they're contradicting my lust, they are wrong. If I were to do this and they say, you can't do that, that's wrong. But you're arguing from a basis of a book that is just human. Then I don't care if you think I'm wrong. You're wrong. And I'll just go ahead and do what I want to do. That's the issue. So at the root of it, Paul is just trying to distance the gospel from the human ingenuity angle. But he's also attempting to do the alternative. And that is, he is attempting to characterize the gospel as being a direct revelation from the God of the universe. I think that's just as given as his attempt to distance it from human ingenuity. It's a given that he's trying to say, what I told you when I was there is so absolutely immutably true that you cannot reject it without suffering the consequences that unbelief always brings. This is absolute immutable truth. That's what he's trying to get across. And let's think about that. What is the significance of a directly divine message? What's the real point there? I mean, Jesus came into the world. He was incarnated. We know that means that he was enfleshed. He was encased in a body of flesh as divine, a God in human flesh. What was the point of that, according to John 1? The Word was made flesh and dwelt among us, and we what? Beheld His glory. All right? So Jesus was incarnated so that we could see the glory of God in human flesh. We could see a visible demonstration of the character of God in the actions of a body that we could actually watch with our eyes. But did that incarnation of the glory convince men that he was who he said he was? Was the vast majority of the reaction? Oh, he's John the Baptist, he's some prophet. He's a deceiver. He's filled with the devil. And all the range of all of these conclusions that were drawn from this revelation, as clear a revelation as you'll ever have. So when we look at that, we say, okay, what's wrong with man? What's wrong with man that he cannot see God in the flesh of Jesus? And then, if you go one further step, the gospel is a written rendition of that word of God that is Jesus. But how do most people respond to the Bible as a written rendition of the living word? It's still somewhat less than it ought to be. I mean, the Bible doesn't carry the weight in our thinking that it ought to, because there should never be a situation of our experience that we face an issue of decision and don't ask ourselves, what does the Bible say about this? There should never be one. But in any given period of 24/7, How many times does that question really come to your mind in all the choices that you're making? How many times do you actually stop and say, what's the Bible say about this? And why don't we stop and ask that? Well, it'd be a waste of time, right? We wouldn't know anyway. So what does the Bible say about it? Well, I don't know. Well, how am I going to find out? Well, I guess I could start reading in Genesis. But I'll never get to this decision if I have to read from Genesis to Revelation to answer this question. So I'm just going to make the decision, okay? I got too much to do today. I can't read from Genesis to Revelation to find out the answer here. So I'm just going to decide, okay? So we don't ask the question because we know we don't have the answer anyway. So, but the danger in that is that we're making decisions and pursuing actions, and we live in a cause and effect universe where actions are creating reactions, and there is no safe bad action. So, and besides that, what's the problem even when a person does know what the Bible says about this? What do the vast majority of them do? Well, I don't care, I'm going to do it anyway. Because what they're actually saying is, okay, if it really is true, if there really are these consequences, I mean, you know, I'm still going to do this. That's a bad deal. So, given the fact that that's the way it is, there's nobody in here that would actually argue that that's not the way it is in our culture and generation. That's the way it is. There are a few people who take it seriously, but the vast majority. Okay, then what's the real point of divine revelation? I mean, what's the real point of Jesus being here in the flesh and having a Bible that's written in words? What's the real point? Why does Paul want us to understand that he got this message by revelation from Jesus Christ, if in fact getting it from Jesus Christ by revelation doesn't make any difference anyhow, for the most part? So what's the point? Well, I think that on the one hand, what God chooses to do has to have a good reason behind it. There has to be a legitimate point. But on the other hand, divine revelation won't make any difference to flesh and blood. As long as we're caught in this incompetency thing, it won't do us any good. We can get a doctor's degree in theology, go to the best Bible teaching seminary in the world, and still come away with no understanding if it's all flesh and blood accomplished. And you can get a doctor's degree in theology by flesh and blood. You can. You don't even have to be a believer. You just have to be able to lie. I mean, the seminary will require you to say that you're a believer. So you have to lie. But you can still get a doctor's degree from there, as long as you can do the work and turn in the assignment. So the real issue here is that divine revelation has a point, but it won't make a difference to flesh and blood. The biblical message is that divine revelation has to be reinforced with more divine revelation. In other words, the revelation of Jesus in the flesh had to be reinforced by a revelation by the Father to Peter before this revelation meant for Peter that he was the Christ. In other words, divine revelation has to be undergirded with more divine revelation, which needs to be undergirded with more divine revelation, which needs to be undergirded with more divine revelation. In other words, the point of divine revelation is to take us incrementally into a recognition and confidence in the truth. And that's an incremental development thing where God takes us through the paces. He reveals a thing to us as true. And then when we begin to hesitate about the consequences, He reveals the next stage of the truthfulness of that, and overrules our hesitation and gives us confidence. And then He moves to the next level, because we're going to have more objections than we can deal with in our life. I mean, life is not going to flow the way we want it to day after day after day. We're going to be faced with challenges to everything about the life we're living sooner or later. I've been a Christian now for over 40 years. And everything that I was initially very much afraid of, I have had to face. So, be encouraged. If you're afraid of it, you're going to face it. Why? Because that's the only way you get over it. If you don't have to face it, you won't get over it. But if you have to face it, you'll get over it or die trying. And God will not let you die trying. He will get you over it. So the biblical thing about divine revelation is that God just keeps doing it. He just keeps revealing and revealing and revealing and revealing. So what's the bottom line? Well, the bottom line is this. The statement, I did not immediately or immediately I did not consult with flesh and blood, is in a sense an introduction to us to this reality. That in order for us to live, God is going to be involved in all of the details at every stage. All of the details at every stage. It's a part of the warp and woof of God's creation that for life to result, He has to be involved at every level. That makes the deist's view wrong, where God just creates it, winds it up like a clock, and walks off. It'll just run on its own. It will not. For life to result, God has to be involved day by day by day, detail by detail by detail, conviction by conviction by conviction, so that we grow in our ability to see this is true and trust in it. And also, He has to be involved at an objective in history kind of revelation, that is, incarnation and written word. That makes the mystics wrong. The deists say that God doesn't need to do anything after He's wound it up and set it on the mantle. It'll run now. That will not produce life. God has to be involved. But the mystics say, well, we really don't need the Bible, or, you know, we just have this direct connection with God. Well, that's not true. The fact that Peter was able to say, you are the Christ, was not directly or exclusively attributable to God revealing that to him. The way God revealed it to him was healing lepers, raising the dead, hearing the words of the teaching and all of that. And God pulling all that together and saying, okay, this is the truth about that. But that has to be there for God to pull it all together and say, okay, this is the truth about that. So, that's the reason why we have all this external objective stuff, because God's not just going to zap it into our brain. It's going to come through these methods or means. So, I think the bottom line then is this. The significance of Paul's attribution of the gospel being directly from God, having nothing to do with man's incompetence, flesh and blood, the significance of that is this. God has entered into the play-by-play of all of the details of our days in every case where we get to live. Where life is the issue for an individual, God is there. And He's working in the details. And He's guiding the thoughts. And He's guiding the conclusions of the mind. And He's adjusting the values of the heart. And He's guiding the... And He's doing this at all the levels. And that's when we come alive. Because as He reveals these things as true, and we see them as true, and we say, oh, I didn't know that was true. If that's true, then I can do this. And we live. That's what I believe Paul is really driving at in Galatians. He is not just interested in a theologically correct argument on whether salvation is by faith. No, no. He's interested in people coming to life. And in order for them to do that, they have to jettison any confidence they have in flesh and blood out the door. But at the same time, they have to replace the vacuum of that excommunication of that. They have to replace it with a confidence that God is here now, involved in the details, working in the detail, doing the stuff that is helping us to understand who He is, what He's like, and what we can expect today and tomorrow and the next day on the basis of that. And that's how we grow. And if that's not happening, we're not growing. Because life requires that. Okay.